Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for March 5th, 2010. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, methane gas venting to the atmosphere, metal protein complexes that make strong, stretchy fibers, and challenges for stem cell science. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about blood infected with DNA, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
The East Siberian Arctic Shelf is about 2 million square kilometers, and it lies, on average, about 50 meters below the surface of the Arctic Ocean. That means, on geologic timescales, the whole area gets repeatedly exposed above the ocean surface and inundated below it. When the shelf was last above the ocean surface, researchers believe it froze and became permafrost. But for the many thousands of years the shelf has been below the ocean surface, scientists think it's been exposed to a greater variability of temperatures, extrapolating from the temperatures scientists can measure today. That greater variability, particularly warmer temperatures, means that any methane gas frozen within the shelf or trapped beneath it might leak or vent. In a paper in this week's Science, Natalia Shakhova and colleagues report extensive methane venting from sediments of the East Siberian Arctic Shelf, providing a first set of data points to reference for future studies as to the possible effects of this methane venting on the global climate. I spoke with Shakhova from her office at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks.
We found that emissions of methane from the East Siberian Arctic Shelf, which is the largest and the shallow shelf of the world ocean, is significant as emissions from entire world ocean.
How does the amount of methane you and your team estimate is venting from the East Siberian Arctic Shelf compare with the global methane emission estimates?
So what we estimated recently is our first approach. We developed this original approach to incorporate a few different components of emissions. And the initial numbers we currently reporting doesn't sound alarming. This is between the 6.5 terogram a year to 10 terogram a year. Compared with the global budget, it's not significant amount, but considering that we deal with Arctic shell, which has never been considered a source of methane to the atmosphere, this is significant amount, and especially if compared with the total emissions from the world ocean. And this is initial numbers, and we did not incorporate few very important components of emissions, which being incorporated might change our first estimate significantly, because what we did not incorporate is non-gradual emissions, non-gradual, sudden, or kind of outburst-like emissions, which usually associated with methane emission as bubbles from the seabed through the water column and directly into the atmosphere, which is associated with destabilization of seabed deposits, we think.
Have you and your team measured any local changes to the atmosphere that you can attribute to this venting?
So what we did, actually, we did multi-level measurements. We study and we measure methane in the bottom layer of water, in the surface layer of water, then in the atmospheric layer right above the seawater, sea surface. And then in 2006, we did the helicopter survey. So we measured the atmospheric levels of methane up to 2,000 meters high. And that allowed us thinking that this particular shelf water surface as a methane source. Because what we measured right above the seawater was spike-like increases and declines in atmospheric levels, which usually are registered close to the sources. And what we measured in the atmospheric layers up to 2,000 meters high was increased relative to background levels of atmospheric methane in the atmosphere for these particular latitudes up to 5-10%. And you can realize that if we consider Arctic to provide atmospheric methane maxima compared to the entire globe, it is levels up to 1.85 compared to 1.7 for the entire globe. And what we have in the atmosphere of the East Siberian Arctic Shelf it's additional 5-10% of increase. This is what we measured.
So is the methane just naturally, gradually releasing? This is a natural instability, or do you and your team suppose another human cause?
Yes, I understand what you're talking about, and I understand what is the context of your question, but as I can realize now, no one can answer this question, taking this responsibility to say, is it gradually releasing through the seabed, or it could be released suddenly? What I personally think about this stuff is that the permafrost, when we deal with subsea permafrost acts as a lid, as a seal to prevent this methane escape. And being prevented for a period of time, being sealed for a period of time, means that this gas accumulates, and it accumulates under high pressure. This is what we have, to give an example, this is what we have, for example, this bottle of champagne. So you have a lot of gas inside, but it's sealed for a period of time. And when you uncork this bottle, what you can see, it's different from a bottle of mineral water left open for a period of time. It's just a little bit of different. And I think that release of methane from this kind of seabed deposits disturbed by destabilization of subsea permafrost provides a pathway for this methane, ready-to-go methane, because its release does not depend on production, it's not time-dependent, it's not temperature-dependent, it only needs the pathway to be released. And for me, destabilization of subsea permafrost, not even everywhere, because, for example, we have areas, fault zones, rift zones, tectonically active areas, and so on, and destabilization of hydrates, if it takes place, also can simulate kind of endoseismic events due to sediment settlement and adjustment. And this is not even a gradual process, as every physical process, when you go from one stage to another stage, it's never even, it's kind of jump start. It's, for example, when you see one day, when it is ice break time, and you see one day in the evening, you see the huge lake covered with broken ice, and the next morning, you cannot see a single piece of ice on this lake. That means that the melting of this ice reached the melting boiling point, and it's just jump into the next stage, which is fluid.
So it sounds as if it's not a linear process. It could become...
It's definitely not a linear process. This is what I mean. It's not linear. That's why establishing these first numbers, first estimates, this is just very first phase in our work. This is kind of to set up a reference point. From this reference point, we can focus on, because having no background, having no initial estimates, it's hard to provide with details. But now we are thinking of providing details, and we do have some materials already from 2009 expedition, which we are just very anxious to prepare for publication. But speaking of this current paper, this is what my thoughts about.
Natalia Shakhova, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Natalia Shakhova of the University of Alaska Fairbanks on the extensive methane venting to the atmosphere from sediments of the East Siberian Arctic Shelf. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, is under increasing scrutiny because of recent revelations of inaccuracies related to the melting of the Himalayan glaciers and the percent of the Netherlands below sea level. Here with more about the IPCC's response is Science Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel.
The IPCC announced on February 27th that it will seek external review of the procedures used in developing its assessments of global climate. The IPCC has approached the United Nations Environment Program to collaborate on establishing an independent review process. The plan is to present the report of the reviewing body at the October meeting of the IPCC in the Republic of Korea. This will hopefully help to improve procedures for the fifth climate assessment, which is due in 2014. One chief concern is finding individuals with both sufficient expertise and the ability to provide an independent review of the process, as many of the world's leading climate scientists have been involved in writing or reviewing the IPCC assessments. Further details about the review are to be released in early March.
That was Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. Engineers know pretty well at this point what makes materials strong, and they know pretty well what makes materials stretchy. But when it comes to making a material both strong and stretchy, researchers still look to nature for inspiration. In a paper published online by Science, Matt Harrington and colleagues report the makeup and their team's model of the marine mussel's byssus, the strong, stretchy threads that mussels produce that allows them to stay attached to rocky shores. I spoke with Harrington from his office at the Max Planck Institute for Colloids and Interfaces in Potsdam, Germany.
If you've ever been on the coast during a big winter storm and seen these huge waves crashing down on the rocks, you can imagine it's not a very friendly place to live. It's not very easy to stay attached there. And so you have these large wave forces, and you also have a problem with more or less sandblasting. So waterborne debris that are being thrown and are also hitting these organisms. So any organisms that survive in this zone, they have to have some pretty special adaptations that allow them to survive here. And we study the mussel, we study their byssus, and the byssus is a group of 50 to 100 threads that they use to attach to the hard surfaces. These threads are stiff but stretchy, so they can stretch up to twice their initial length. And they're acting as shock absorbers, and basically so when the force of a wave is coming down, you often have pull and drag forces that are trying to rip the mussel off the rock, and these threads are actually dissipating and absorbing some of this energy so that this doesn't happen.
What are some of the applications that engineers would like to have these kinds of materials for?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And as a fundamental researcher, it's really not what we do here. And so for me to actually say what this could definitively be used for would kind of be speculation at this point. But I mean, I could imagine some sorts of biomedical applications where you would want to have a kind of a flexible thread or flexible fiber that is wear resistant, that's not going to just kind of tear apart once it faces some harsh conditions. But I think the most important thing is kind of the idea of having a coating that can stretch, that can also be as hard as an epoxy.
Okay. What did you and your team find then that gives the byssal its strength and stretchiness?
So you have the inner core of the thread as a whole. You have these two parts. You have the outer coating and the inner core. The inner core is this really stretchy, soft material. It's this collagen-based material, and it's been previously studied. But if it was on its own without a coating, we imagine that the abrasion that's coming from sand being thrown around and rubbing against rocks, it wouldn't last very long in this environment. So then on top of it, the mussel is laying down this very thin but hard outer coating. It's about five times harder. And then this outer coating has this very granular morphology. So these, if you look at it really close under TEM or SEM, so scanning electron microscopy or transmission electron microscopy, what you see are these tiny micron-sized granules that are basically more or less embedded into this intergranular matrix. These are the names we give it. And so these granules, what we showed in our study was that the granules have a much higher abundance of these metal crosslinks, significantly higher, and that the metal crosslinks are still present in the matrix, but at much lower amounts. Okay.
And what do the crosslinks do? What do they enable?
So the idea of a crosslink in general is, I mean, basically crosslinking a material is making it stiffer and harder. It makes it harder to pull apart these protein chains. So the crosslinks are existing between the proteins. Okay. So two different protein chains are being linked together by a metal ion. Okay. And this is what we're calling a crosslink. And then it's more difficult for something that has more crosslinks than something that has less crosslinks to pull it apart. So basically, this material will have harder characteristics than a less crosslinked material.
So it's the crosslinks, not the metal itself, that's making it a harder material.
Exactly. But the metal is mediating the crosslink. So on the proteins, you have these amino acids. They're post-translationally modified amino acids called DOPA. And this is kind of a rare modification of tyrosine, and it adds an extra hydroxyl group. And by adding this extra hydroxyl group, the DOPA is able to very, very strongly complex to metal ions. And what you have in the protein is that up to three of these DOPA residues can bind a single iron ion. So what you have then is DOPA residues from up to two or three different chains of protein binding to a single metal ion. And then this is what we call a crosslink.
Is iron the only metal that's employed here?
Iron is the most common metal, but because the muscle is a very opportunistic creature, it's basically taking this metal from the environment. It's a filter feeder, so it's pulling the water through its system, and then it's extracting the metals from the water and then concentrating them into this coating. And so they've found that muscles that are growing near some industrial plants that are using titanium, for instance, will show evidence of titanium in their Bissell threads. So it is opportunistic, but iron is one of the ions that binds best. It binds the strongest with DOPA. And so this is why typically we find iron in there.
How did you and your team go about finding what makes up this outer coating?
This has been some work that's been done a long time ago by our co-author Herbert Waite at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And he worked to purify a lot of the proteins that make up the thread in a whole. And one of them that caught his interest right away was what we call MEFP1. And for a long time, it was thought that this was one of the adhesive proteins that's responsible for allowing the muscle to stick to stones, like basically the underwater glue. But after a while, it became apparent that this wasn't in the glue. It was actually in the outer coating. And that then we were able to see that this is making up the majority of the outer coating. And so then there were further studies after that that showed, yes, okay, there's this protein MEFP1 in the coating, but then there's also a large amount of metals. And so it was proposed for a long time that because MEFP1 was known to have so much DOPA and DOPA was known to bind so well to iron ions, that it seemed only natural that they would interact somehow. But up until this point, it had never been convincingly shown. And that's where our study came in with the Raman spectroscopy.
And what does the Raman spectroscopy show you?
So the Raman spectroscopy shows a very, very distinctive set of peaks, resonance peaks, that arise from the interaction between DOPA and iron. So basically, once we were, you know, hitting this material with the laser, these peaks just showed up and we knew instantly that, okay, this is what we have here is DOPA iron complexation or DOPA metal complexation. And then we were also able to show using EDTA, which is a metal chelator, which is able to basically, it was already previously shown that EDTA can pull metals out of the cuticle. So it can strip the cuticle of all its iron. And it was shown in a previous paper that when you pull the metal out of the cuticle, then the hardness is being reduced by half. So what we wanted to see, well, how does this correlate with the Raman signal that we get from DOPA iron? And so what we found was once we treated this with EDTA, we were also able to completely remove the DOPA iron coordination signal. And then by treating the thread again with a solution of iron chloride, we're able to bring back the same or a very similar Raman resonance signal, showing that not only can we pull this metal out, but we can put it back in.
It sounds as if this material can regenerate itself.
Yeah, I mean, this gets at an important point about this material that we're really interested in further pursuing is that this kind of shows that this is a type of material that can be tailored. So by removing certain amounts of metal, putting a certain amount back in, it's possible. We haven't shown this yet, but maybe we can kind of tailor the mechanical response of the material as a whole. And then another point that the removal and reformation of these bonds gets at is the idea of basically you can break and reform these bonds. And something we are actively pursuing now and haven't shown yet is whether or not these miniature cracks that form, once they crack, whether they can heal afterwards. So this is another interesting possibility of this material, is that it could be, you know, you form these small cracks and then they can actually heal themselves afterwards. However, I have to say, we don't have the evidence for this quite yet, and it's something that we're actively pursuing.
Matt Harrington, thank you very much.
Yep, no problem.
Matt Harrington of the Max Planck Institute in Potsdam, Germany, on a metal-based biological strategy for hard, flexible coatings. Find the paper online at www.scienceexpress.org. Whether embryonic, adult, or induced pluripotent stem cells, many researchers think stem cells will lead to the medicines and therapies of the future. But there are varied interests, political, ethical, and scientific, that have divided the public, scientists themselves, and policymakers as to the best way to proceed with stem cell science, or, indeed, whether to proceed at all. Reprogramming adult somatic cells, the iPS or induced pluripotent stem cells, was an advance heralded as a potential way forward that avoided the ethical concerns of using embryonic stem cells. But as Gretchen Vogel reports in a News of the Week article in This Week Science, iPS cells so far are coming up short when compared to embryonic stem cells, highlighting that cellular reprogramming is still an inexact science. In rethinking that inexact science, a panel of researchers at the AAAS meeting in San Diego 2 weeks ago discussed a whole range of issues related to stem cells. George Daly of Children's Hospital, Harvard Medical School, puts the development of stem cells into context.
So the last 100 years has seen an enormous benefit to medicine from turning chemistry into medicines, right? So we can deliver drugs. There was a lot of skepticism that we'd be able to learn how to control the production of proteins, which were more complex than small molecules. But now, after, you know, 30 years of investment by the biotechnology community, we have fabulous medicines based on antibodies and proteins. There's similar reluctance and skepticism in the pharmaceutical industry and the biotechnology industry that we'll ever be able to figure out how to make cells a business model and a deliverable for patients. How do you think about an off-the-shelf product with cells? But that is the long-term future. And I'm talking very long-term. It may be decades. But it is part of the promise of this field. The problem is that we have this tendency for people to jump towards the entrepreneurship and try to translate cells into medicines much more rapidly than they deserve, because the science isn't there yet.
One of the ways the science is there is with stem cells recovered from umbilical cord blood. But Irving Weissman of Stanford University Medical School says the usefulness of these cells is very limited.
Umbilical cords contain blood-forming stem cells at a level that would maintain the blood-forming capacity of a very young child. They also could have derived what's called mesenchymal or fibroblast-like cells that have a very limited capacity to make scar, bone, fat. They don't make brain. They don't make lung. They don't make heart. They don't make skeletal muscle, despite what various people claim. There are a whole group of unproven stem cell therapeutic clinicians, websites, clinics, that very cleverly go to a country where there are poor medical regulations to do the therapies. Then they let the patients go on their own, short of maybe $50,000, $100,000, $150,000 for a therapy that has no chance, taken away from a family that needs them at a time when they are having an incurable disease. It is wrong.
Of course, that willingness to take an ethical stance is not unique to those scientists who want to study and use stem cells. Ethical considerations prompted policymakers to limit funding for stem cell research in the United States. And at present, access for federally funded researchers is limited to 43 lines of embryonic stem cells, even under the new guidelines enacted by the Obama administration. Remarkably, only one line of those approved for study during the Bush administration is also on the new registry, meaning researchers risk losing much of the benefit of the past decade of research on embryonic stem cells.
The Bush lines are very important for basic research.
Rudolf Janisch is a stem cell researcher at Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
Because much research went into those, and now not to be able to use them is a very severe handicap for many, including us, because we made lots of data with these approved lines.
though many people argue that iPS technology, reprogramming adult cells so that they behave like embryonic stem cells, makes the study and derivation of new embryonic stem cells unnecessary. Again, Rudolf Janisch.
Do we need new human embryonic stem cells? I would absolutely say yes. The reason is the following. We know that embryonic stem cells are different from other embryonic stem cells. They are isolated with a, I would think, historic protocol established by Jamie Thompson. It works well. It's good. But is it really the... What is a good embryonic stem cell? And when we make iPS cells, what do you have to strive at? We don't know what a good ES cell is. If you change the conditions of isolation of embryonic stem cells, how you treat the embryo and the very early passages, that will influence fundamentally, will fundamentally make these cells different at 60 passages many months later. So the very early stage, how you treat the embryo and the embryonic stem cells makes a difference how these cells behave in the later stages. To me, this is like wherever you went to high school, that imprinted you in a way which you will be influenced by as you're an adult. You cannot get rid of that. So you get an irreversible imprint. And I would argue we have to define the ground state of pluripotency, because that's what we have to strive at to make iPS cells like. At the moment, we have hundreds and hundreds of embryonic stem cells derived in a conventional way, and I would argue this may not be the only way and maybe even not the best way of doing it.
And figuring out the best way to do it so that scientists can understand the true ground state of pluripotency will help with understanding how adult stem cells work too, says Fred Gage. Gage studies the adult central nervous system at the Salk Institute for Biological Sciences in La Jolla, California.
One thing that's becoming clear is that there are primitive cells that exist throughout the central nervous system and the spinal cord. They don't give rise to functioning neurons under normal conditions, but under injury conditions, they can change or contribute in some of the repair processes that are going on. One way in which the work that George and Rudy talked about is related to the work that's going on in the central nervous system now is this concept of reprogramming, that a somatic cell, a regular cell, can be in some ways de-differentiated or changed into another cell. And now there's evidence in organs, adult organs, that some cells, under certain circumstances, can be induced to switch fate between one cell and another. And that highlights a point that while I'm talking about the adult nervous system and the residual stem cells that exist in that organ, this concept of adult stem cells is one that permeates all organs. So essentially all organs have stem cells in them. They're not like the pluripotent cells that you've heard about. These are quite restricted in their capacity of what they can become, and generally they're related to the organ in which they reside. But there is much to learn about this, and there's great interest in the ability to learn from the more primitive cells in being able to direct these cells in different directions endogenously. So it's a concept of endogenous repair.
Endogenous repair, or repair from within, a type of regenerative medicine. Again, Irving Weissman of Stanford University Medical School.
The only cell that self-renews by making more of itself is the stem cell for that tissue. That means it's the only cell that's important in regenerative medicine. They're not only there in development after the embryonic phase of partitioning the body into different regions, they're important in development, for maintenance. So the tissue-specific stem cells that we work with are blood-forming in the beginning. And we've already transplanted pure blood-forming stem cells into people who have cancer, and we know they work to regenerate the system better than a transplant that contains all of the cells, including T cells or cancer cells. Now, the idea that stem cells can regenerate tissues should allow us to take advantage of embryonic or other pluripotent stem cells to find the blood-forming stem cell to establish an immune system from that donor, the embryonic stem cell line, and then to co-transplant a brain-forming stem cell or a lung-forming stem cell to regenerate the tissues. That's not now, of course, that's very soon.
And in addition to regenerating healthy tissues, researchers like Owen Witt at UCLA want to regenerate unhealthy tissues too, like cancer. Witt studies how cancers grow and spread.
One of the approaches that we've taken based on the work generated in the stem cell field is to think about cancer as a disease of stem cells, where cancer starts, how the genetic damage, whether it's caused by environmental influences such as smoking or exposure to toxins, or genetic influences you may be born with or acquire, accumulate a series of changes that leads the normal stem cell to lose its regularized behavior and instead turn into an incipient cancer and then a more selected and growing anaplastic cancer. To understand those changes, one of the things we need are better systems with which to study them. When you have a leukemia to study, you can withdraw blood or bone marrow relatively easily, but for the solid tumors, sampling and modeling become rate limiting. So what we've concentrated on is the development of a new series of approaches, which are really based on concepts from stem cell medicine, stem cell biology, and regenerative medicine, to, in a sense, regenerate tissues and regenerate cancer in a stepwise manner. The concept there is not only to show what works, but also to develop model systems different from the ones we have in order to test new therapeutics.
But developing those therapeutics, Witt says, is going to take investment by academic institutions.
The only way that the cellular therapeutics area will become a reality is for academia to go ahead and do it and prove that the concept works. And the level of funding required to build the types of good manufacturing practices, laboratories that are necessary to do the cell processing is quite high. So there has to be special attention to that point if the system is going to get through the bottleneck of not just postulating how something would work, but actually demonstrate how it would work. It's not a trivial issue because it requires capital investment for something that would not realize a therapy for some years to come.
And academics will have to take the lead, adds Irving Weissman of Stanford University Medical School, because industry and venture capitalists won't. That's because there's no long-term use of stem cell therapies. You just do it once.
We have a medical establishment and a pharmaceutical industry that instinctively thinks of drugs chronically given, so self-renewal to that company and to people like me means I remember every day to take my pill. But if you have a stem cell therapy, it's once for life because the cells self-renew, not because we tell them what to do, but because they know what to do.
But researchers will still need some time before they know what stem cells do. In the meantime, says Rudolf Janisch of MIT, they'll use these kinds of patient-specific stem cells as models for diseases and for drug screening.
The hype of saying that the cell therapy of these diseases are on the corner is really, I think, is dangerous. That's a hype which is, I think, one shouldn't do. I think the immediate application of the iPS technology is to make patient-specific cells, let's say of a patient with a complex disease such as Parkinson's or Alzheimer's, put these cells in the culture dish, differentiate them to the neurons, in this case, the neurons which are damaged and die in the patient, then ask the question, is there a phenotype? Is there a difference when you do this with these patient-derived embryonic stem cells as compared to a control person's derived stem cells? If you find a difference, then you can ask the question, is it relevant for the phenotype in the patient, and can we use these cells to screen for small molecules which would prevent the appearance of the phenotype or would delay the appearance of the phenotype? If you find such a drug, it's a direct line, I believe, to a drug which could possibly used in the future in patients. So I think this is the enormous potential of these iPS technology. I think the key issue is, can we find a relevant phenotype in the culture dish? And that, I think, is at the moment the biggest challenge.
We're in a very exciting field.
Again, George Daly of Children's Hospital, Harvard Medical School.
But there are still the need to define better methods for reprogramming cells so that they become closer to the classical embryonic stem cells. And that we need to have a deeper understanding of the nature and behavior of ES cells and iPS cells. And so for the foreseeable future, we're going to have a tremendous interest in studying both.
You can read more about how ES and iPS cells stack up in Gretchen Vogel's News of the Week article titled "Reprogrammed Cells Come Up Short, for Now." You'll find it in this week's Science. Finally today, David Graham, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about blood infected with DNA. DNA is everywhere in the body, right? Is there some mystery as to how it got there?
Well, Rob, this is actually a very big mystery in medicine. Just to back up a little bit, what happens sometimes is a patient will come to the hospital, they say broken their leg, and they're treated for that broken leg. But a couple of days later, they develop a high fever, their lungs get really inflamed as if they're fighting off a lung infection. Basically, their body's acting like they have this, you know, serious bacterial infection, even though all they have is a broken bone. And doctors have been trying to figure out what's going on. Originally, they thought, well, maybe, you know, somehow by breaking the bone, bacteria got into the bloodstream or something like that. So they've been trying to figure out, well, what exactly is going on here? Why are these patients acting like they have this severe infection when they don't have an infection at all? They couldn't find any bacteria in the bloodstream, which is what you would expect to see if patients are sort of having this response.
And it's DNA in the bloodstream?
And that gets back to DNA. What researchers found in this new study was when they really closely looked at plasma, which is the colorless fluid in which blood cells are suspended, they were finding not bacteria, and they looked at plasma in a bunch of patients that had come into the hospital with, you know, various breaks and other types of injuries that wouldn't necessarily lend themselves to a bacterial infection. When the researchers looked at this plasma, they didn't see bacteria. What they saw was a bunch of mitochondrial DNA. And mitochondria, as you know, Rob, these are the powerhouses of the cell. These are what give cells their energy. And opposed to nuclear DNA, mitochondria actually have their own DNA that actually gets passed down directly from mother to child.
So the body isn't identifying it as its own?
No, somehow, well, what's happening, the researchers think, is when you have an injury, like a severe injury, like a broken bone, it's somehow ripping these cells apart and releasing a lot of this mitochondrial DNA and even these bits and pieces of mitochondria into the bloodstream. And somehow the body's responding to this mitochondrial debris as if it were a bacterial invader. And when the body sort of ramps up its immune response like this, you get symptoms very similar to as if you were having a bacterial infection. You would get high fever and inflammation and other symptoms like that.
So what is it about the mitochondrial DNA that makes the body want to attack it?
Well, this is an interesting theory about mitochondria, that they actually used to be bacteria that millions or even billions of years ago were swallowed up by cells. And instead of infecting the cell, they actually became a part of the cell. So all the mitochondria we have in our cells today may have been bacteria billions of years ago. And because of that, they have a lot of the same chemical markers on their surface that bacteria do. And one of these chemical markers is called formal peptide, which is a really common marker that neutrophils, which are these immune cells in your body, use to recognize bacterial invaders. So if they're all of a sudden seeing these markers on the mitochondria in the blood, they start attacking it just as if they were going to start attacking bacteria. The body ramps up its immune response and you get the fever and the inflammation and everything you would get if you really had an honest to goodness bacterial infection.
So mystery solved.
Mystery solved. But there's still one more mystery, which is what should doctors do when a patient presents with these symptoms? Because you don't want to turn off the immune response if the patient really does have an honest-to-goodness bacterial infection. So researchers say there's important clinical implications for this, and this may lead to a new way to treat this syndrome. But doctors first need to make sure that it's actually the mitochondria that are causing the problem and not really bacteria that are causing the problem.
The current treatment now is what? Antibiotics?
Yeah, you would use antibiotics for bacteria, and you obviously don't want to stop doing that if you do have bacteria in the bloodstream.
Okay. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, speaking of misplacing blame, this next story is about how global warming, which was once blamed for the extinction of the golden toad, may not actually have been to blame after all.
What was instead?
Well, Rob, according to this new study, what was to blame instead was natural weather variations. And in this particular case, El Nino.
Where did the golden toad live? And why would that make it particularly susceptible to weather variation?
Well, Rob, the golden toad is this very colorful amphibian. You actually can see a cool picture of one on the site. And it lived in the Costa Rican cloud forest of Monteverde. And the toad was last seen in 1989. Before then, it had really flourished in this area. Then all of a sudden, after 1989, it was gone, completely disappeared, completely extinct. And researchers knew that this area seemed to have been experiencing increased warming over the years. You know, as humans have pumped more carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, places like this region of Costa Verde have become hotter and drier. And that particularly, researchers thought that particularly affected this toad because when amphibians in this region get very hot and dry, they can develop a fatal fungal skin disease. And that actually hurt a lot of amphibians in the area but the golden toad wasn't able to change its habitat as well as some of the other amphibians. So the researchers think that's why it died out. It just wasn't able to adapt to global warming. But there wasn't really any very hard data for this. The problem with this particular forest was that researchers didn't have climate data going back more than about a decade or two. And in order to, you know, be able to blame or not blame something on a condition like global warming, you really have to have long-term temperature data. So in this new study, these researchers did this very painstaking analysis where they took a bunch of core samples from trees in the area, and they actually looked at over 2,000 pieces of wood. And what they were looking at specifically were concentrations of various oxygen isotopes. And these isotopes give clues as the years go on about changes in weather patterns, you know, warm periods, dry periods, wet periods, things like that. And what the researchers were able to do is they were able to create a weather chart for this forest going back over 100 years. And when they did that and they lined it up with trends in global warming and other weather trends, they found that the global warming trends didn't really match up with when the frogs started to become extinct. Instead, they found a very nice correlation with El Nino.
So these are like molecular versions of tree rings?
Something like that.
Is that a very well-established science in terms of understanding temperature variation, things like that?
Well, one critic of the study says that, no, this is actually a fairly new science. So he says that global warming is not off the hook yet just because the data aren't as strong as they could be. So unlike the medical mystery, this may not be a situation of case closed just yet.
And is there a way to actually separate the two? I mean, global warming from El Nino?
Well, the researchers say they feel like their data does separate the two, but they really caution that warming is warming. So just because this particular extinction may not be due to global warming, warming itself did lead to the extinction. It just wasn't warming related to global warming. And so what they're saying is when global warming is impacting other areas, it can have just as dramatic effect as what was seen with the golden toad.
Okay. So last story, what's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from the warm tropics to the cool Arctic, this last story is about what may be one of the very first polar bears that ever existed.
A fossil.
A fossil. And specifically, this is a fossilized jawbone of a polar bear. And it was found in 2004 in Norway's Svalbard archipelago. And what's really interesting about this fossil is, first of all, believe it or not, it's actually very hard to find any fossilized remnants of polar bears. And that's because polar bears, when they die, they tend to get torn apart by their comrades. That scatters their remains everywhere. Also, they're spending a lot of time in their water, and often when they die, they sink to the bottom of the ocean. So scientists have been really hard-pressed to figure out exactly what the history of polar bears are. There's these really wide-ranging estimates of even when polar bears first appeared. Some scientists say they appeared as recently as 50,000 years ago. Others say they've been around for as long as a million years. But because of lack of fossil evidence, it's been really hard to show.
How old is this fossil?
This fossil, based on the layer of sediment that it was found in, is about 120,000 years old. So that's the first clue that at least 120,000 years ago, we had polar bears.
Were scientists able to extract any DNA from this fossil?
Well, that's what they did. They actually drilled into a tooth in the jawbone and were able to extract some mitochondrial DNA. That's something we talked about earlier. And using this DNA, they compared it to mitochondrial DNA from modern polar bears and also from brown bears, which is where polar bears are thought to have evolved from. And what they found was that the DNA matched up very well with modern polar bears, indicating that this jawbone belonged to a polar bear. But they also found some genetic markers indicating that the DNA had some elements of the brown bear in it. And that suggests to the researchers that this was a very early polar bear because it hadn't completely transitioned out of being a brown bear into being a polar bear. It was almost sort of an intermediate form. Although it was more polar bear than brown bear, it's very, very rare to find these sort of transitional forms in the fossil record.
Climate-wise, what was going on during this time that might have prompted this evolution of the polar bear?
Well, Rob, around 120,000 years ago, Earth's climate was actually a lot warmer than it is today, especially in this region where this fossil was found. And so it was easier for these nascent polar bears to exist in this region at this time. And what researchers think happened is as the years went by and this region became the much colder region we know today, these early polar bears adapted. They developed their much thicker coats than the brown bears have. They also had other adaptations like shorter ears and longer necks, things that helped them survive better in the cold and also that helped them survive better as hunters in the water than the brown bear would have been. What's really interesting here is that researchers have really found this point in time where all this really began to start happening.
So evidence for the origins of polar bears. Mystery number 3 out of 3 for this week.
We're batting pretty well this week, Rob.
Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about what killed the dinosaurs. There's been a lot of theories floating around, and researchers say they finally have the definitive evidence of what wiped out these ancient beasts. And for physics geeks...
like me.
We've got a story on antimatter. And on the science policy blog, Science Insider, we've got stories about how the Chilean quake last week affected astronomy in that country. And also a new report about what the state of science is in the United Kingdom. So be sure to check out all of these stories on our brand new site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the March 5th, 2010 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, the Science Society, thanks for joining us.